Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
Yeah, we love books so much that we bought, like, 3 million copies of A Book of Poetry.
Yes, we did. And by that, we mean we bought one and copied it 3 billion times.
Yep. Shared it across the sphere.
Don't tell the poet.
Also, none of us read it. So there's that.
Well, there is that, yes. Had it just to look cool. Oh, look what I have on my shelf.
I have the Kantos and Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
So apparently that's a thing in the future. Hyperion wins the award for best description of Hitler. I don't know. Some Earth politician who also was a writer.
Yeah.
Okay. Not really, but...
In the far future, no one will give a shit about Hitler. Though since this version of the future has the internet, I doubt that.
Yeah, the internet loves Hitler.
Or at least they love to reference him.
My favorite game is to just immediately call someone, compare someone to Hitler, like, before it even gets there.
Invoke a Godwin's Law.
Yep.
As your opening salvo.
Martin Luther King was basically Hitler.
Discuss.
I pissed someone off once by doing that on the internet. Trolling a bit. Anywho. This week we read Hyperion by Dan Simmons.
Yes, a science fiction novel set in the far future.
A Hugo Award winner.
In fact, it is, yes.
We tend to read a lot of science fiction award winners, I feel like.
Yeah, we do. I think they do a... I think the science fiction community does a pretty decent job of picking memorable books for their awards.
Mm-hmm.
So, 20 years later, the ones that are worth reading do tend to be the ones that won the awards or were nominated.
As opposed to when you look at the Oscars and you're like, what the fuck is Oliver doing on the best picture list? Has anyone watched that in the past 20 years? The answer is no. That is the correct answer. Or even more in the more recent past, Crash, which everyone only references by lolling at it. So.
Anymore, yeah.
So good job, science fiction community. Our inspiration for the book was basically just that it was time for science fiction, and because Great Gatsby is so short, Ben suggested we read a longer book, and he likes Hyperion.
Yep, that's basically it.
So nothing too deep or interesting around this time.
You are listening to this podcast to indulge my whims.
Yeah, it's basically true of every episode.
Well,
so.
That's probably...
That's, even when I make you read books.
That is factual.
So. Obviously, the book is science fiction.
Yes.
Let's not cover that anymore.
All right.
Plot synopsis. The Canterbury Tales.
In space!
Yeah, this book is totally The Canterbury Tales in space.
Yeah.
I texted Ben that after like 30 pages.
Yeah. Oh, that's because there's no argument.
Yeah.
That's probably intentional, because Dan Simmons appears to be a giant nerd.
Oh, yes. I would definitely believe that was an intentional. Seven Pilgrims sets up the reason why they're traveling. Someone says, hey, let's tell stories. And the rest of the book is basically just people telling stories. The only difference is that all of the pilgrims get to tell their stories. But in Chaucer's version, I think there were 24 pilgrims, and they were all going to get to tell two stories.
Mm.
So
it's a lot of stories.
Yeah, the fact that that's incomplete is a little, a little different.
That was pretty ambitious, Chaucer.
Yeah, that's why he died before you finished it. Stupid idiot.
He died of writing it.
The knight's okay. I'm fucked.
I'm dead.
Getting out of here.
This is lame.
The Shrike was not pleased.
That's right. The Shrike harvested him.
So, we've been, you know, trying to do brief summaries of all the books, but then Ben and I realized we couldn't really do a brief summary of this book.
The brief summary of this book basically tells you what the Canterbury Tales are, except it's seven pilgrims instead of 24.
Yeah.
Seven pilgrims travel to the world of Hyperion and tell their tales along the way. and then we can summarize each of those tales, but that gets outside of brief summary.
Yeah, so we'll just leave it there. Sorry, any spoiler alerty peoples who wanted summaries, but...
Yeah, and so I guess I will throw out the spoiler alert, as long as we're talking about it, but we will spoil everything, though... That being said, I don't know that there are huge spoilers with this book, because all of the resolutions and spoilers got saved for the sequel.
Yeah, this book, I guess the spoiler is that this book ends before shit really goes down.
It's 480 pages of setup.
Yeah.
Really interesting setup, I think, but yeah, there's another book called The Fall of Hyperion, which I think is actually not the sequel to Hyperion, but the second half of Hyperion.
Yeah, if you... said to yourself, or started reading this book and then went, oh, sweet, there's going to be a crazy battle at the end. That doesn't happen. The book literally ends with the characters singing We're Off to See the Wizard.
Yeah.
And, like, skipping down the road. So there's that.
I got to the end of this book the first time I read it and went, what the hell? And started searching frantically for a sequel.
I was just like, lol. That's dumb.
Hmm.
He really wanted to throw in that reference.
He really did. We're off to see the Shrike.
And then everyone in Kansas went, bah.
The wonderful Shrike of killing you.
Of the time tombs.
Of the time tombs.
So, that being said, the fact that there are seven people telling all of their tales, it will not surprise you to learn that there are multiple settings in multiple times. In addition to that, there are multiple points of view and tenses happening as well.
Yeah, I mean, the primary thread of the pilgrims traveling is taking place on the planet Hyperion. Most of the action with in the different stories is happening within the world web,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I guess it's not all of, it's part of the hegemony?
Hegemony, yes. Yeah.
And so humanity is governed under this gigantic body and group of hundreds of planets called the hegemony. The web is the most civilized part of that. It doesn't include all the colonies. Seems to be defined basically by the planets you can teleport to and from.
That's what I was about to say. The most interesting part there is that you can farcast, which mm-hmm. is basically teleportation. You walk through a portal, you're on a new planet. And if you're part of the web, then your planet can be farcasted to. And if you're not part of the web, then people have to travel to it in the fastest way they can. And
right.
That's when you start incurring... time debt.
Yes, you go via starship. Actually, it's one of the things I like about the setting is that they have farcasting, which is the instantaneous travel, and then you'd faster than light ships. You know, you could go like 20 light years in, say, 4 or 5 years of real time, but you still took on that what they call a time debt,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being able to spin up the engines and be there in a day, like in a lot of science fiction.
Yeah, so it's the thing where they put you into sleep, the ship takes off, you get there 4 years later, you haven't aged at all, but everyone back home has.
Right.
But then they also have fat lines, that's what they're called, right?
Yeah.
Where you can instantaneously communicate with anyone no matter how far away they are.
It's an Ansible.
Yeah. A little left hand of darkness.
Yeah.
So if you're on a planet that's 4 years away from everyone else, you can still talk to them in real time.
Yeah, though it is expensive, I gather.
Yeah. So that's the general setup of the worlds, I guess.
Yeah.
And the hegemony is seeking out new planets to add to their force all the time, essentially. And they're set up against the Ousters, who are... the bad guy, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know that much about them, but they have been attacking the so-called civilized worlds, at least.
I thought of it as, like, a Roman Empire versus the barbarians. Oh, yeah,
that's totally how it's set up. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So.
And yeah, a lot more about them in the sequel, as it so happens. But we're not here to talk about the sequel. So, because it is seven pilgrims all telling their story pretty much with an equal share of each story among them, the decision on who the protagonist is was difficult this week.
Yeah, we had yet another difficult protagonist decision moment, which seems to be happening a lot lately.
Well, what can you do? And so I would argue there is no protagonist with this book.
Yeah, I'm fine with agreeing with that.
I mean, I guess it's one of those things where if you're required to choose one.
Yeah, the console is the closest thing to a protagonist, and mostly because anytime someone's not telling their story and you just have narration, it's more or less centered around his thoughts.
Right.
But even then, he's not really... He's not the one everything centers around, well... Yeah, not really.
Not in a real sense.
And he doesn't change, and...
I guess you get a big reveal about him towards the end. That might be the closest thing to a spoiler this book has. Well, I guess one of the pilgrims doesn't get to tell a story because he's dead.
Because he explodes or something.
Murder by Shrike? Possibly?
Yeah, so we basically just decided there's no protagonist in this book.
Yeah, so the book opens with the consul getting called to Hyperion as part of the pilgrimage.
The Shrike pilgrimage.
Yes.
Should we talk about the Shrike?
I think that makes sense, actually.
Okay.
Because the Shrike is kind of, I don't know, kind of the...
Unifying.
Yeah, almost the unifying force. So the Shrike is this big... silver forearmed, red glowing eyed monster thing that's made out of blades and thorns. And we know not much about it, but it murders people very messily.
It's centered on Hyperion. All the Shrike cults and myths and stuff originated in Hyperion, and people go on pilgrimages to see the Shrike, and a lot of them die.
Many of these pilgrimages are kind of elaborate suicides,
because the Shrike is not, well, obviously if he's made of knives and thorns, he's not a wonderful, benevolent figure.
Maybe he is. He just wants to give you a hug.
And then... It just doesn't end very well. Like Edward Scissorhands.
Right.
He's trying to hug you, but he accidentally cuts you. The gentle soul... Really don't think that's
no, I'm not getting that impression.
People tend to be explodey in his presence. yeah, when a character's made of knives, you can probably guess they're not...
And he does this nifty thing where he's standing in one place, and then in the blink of an eye, he's standing in a completely different place, usually with someone impaled on his thorns.
Yeah. They call him the Lord of Pain for a good reason.
Yes.
And... essentially is the mythology surrounding him that he's basically there to, like, kill everyone and bring about the downfall of man. That's, like, his release kind of thing.
Yeah, I think. We don't really know what the Shrike is or where it comes from. We just know that it's freaky and there's a lot of mythology around it, but it is real.
Yeah, because it shows up at various points throughout the book.
Yes, a couple of characters get to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
Him slash it.
One character gets to meet the Shrike and doesn't even get exploded by it.
I know.
A couple people, now that I think about it.
I know, it's for the couple of stories in, it seemed like that might have been the determining factor in whether you got to be a pilgrim. Did you meet the Shrike without getting murdered by it?
Oh, congratulations.
Then you can go visit it again. Though I don't know why you'd want to after that.
Because it's so nice.
They have their reasons, though.
Cuddled that one guy.
That's true. Lovingly in its arms.
Yeah. It totally did. So I guess we could just start talking about the pilgrim.
Yeah, I try to take them in order the best my memory will allow me to. But you have Lenar Hoyt, who is a Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm.
There's pretty much one planet where Catholics hang out anymore, it sounds like.
Yeah, and a planet or two for Jews, and...
right.
A couple.
The old religions still exist, but they're pretty small.
Yeah.
No one...
Kind of diminishing, and...
Most people don't really remember him, I think.
Yeah.
But his story is actually the story of Paul Duret, another priest.
Priest, yeah.
Priest who's pretty much just banished. We're not 100% sure why.
Yeah.
Some sort of heresy related to archaeological findings.
Yeah, he made some comment about if this was around before Christianity on Earth or something, and then people freaked out and
banished. So, I mean, as far as Hoyt goes, he knew Duret for, like, a trip to the planet. And that's it.
Like 3 months like, or something?
Well, yeah. Not very long. And the story he tells is, well, it involves Father Duret going through a scary-sounding forest where all the trees spit lightning at you.
Yeah. That was pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
The fire forest.
And then finding a group of people who were curiously similar to each other.
Yeah, a group of people who don't seem too bright. They
right.
can talk a little bit.
He compares them in, like, behavior and appearance to people with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Just to kind of give you an idea, like, they function, but they don't seem to think abstractly too much.
Yeah, because they can go foraging for food, and, you know, they're capable of building their huts and stuff, but when they have downtime, they just sit in their huts and sit there, essentially.
Yeah. Also, unlike people with Down syndrome, they're pretty expressionless, for the most part.
Uh-huh. And kind of fucked up.
Kind of creepy, yeah. That whole story has a lot of creep factor around
it. Yes, it does.
It's kind of disturbing.
Yeah, the main... Well, I guess if we're talking about characterization...
Right, yeah.
Then I don't want to bring any of that up yet. So, in this story, I would say that you don't really get a ton of characterization. You just kind of get a reveal, and that's about it.
Yeah, with all the weird stuff going on. And Father Duret is, I mean, he's pretty curious. He's definitely going in, like, the more Jesuit tradition, I think, of intellectualism. But
it seems to have a huge crush on a guy named Edward.
Yeah, he keeps talking to Edward. I figured you'd have to mention that at some point.
Boyfriend.
Yeah, we can only hope. But yeah, there are these weird cruciform things, these weird organic cross things that basically make it impossible for you to die.
Yeah.
They resurrect you in 3 days, which seems like a convenient length of time for something like that. And, yeah, Father Hoyt finds Father Duret nailed to a tree in the fire forest, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Continually dying and being reborn.
Yeah, it's pretty fucked up.
It was pretty fucked up. And now Hoyt is carrying a couple of the crosses. And we probably know even less about him. We just know that he's in pain and on very heavy doses of drugs because apparently these things cause, like, the worst pain ever if you go more than 5 or 10 kilometers from their cave.
Yeah, and he's pretty far away.
He's off planet at the beginning of the story.
And he has 2 cruciforms on him, so the assumption is that one of those cruciforms is Father Duret's, and that at some point he might, like, somehow come into being
bud
again.
Off of him, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty freaky.
He's messed up. And you have Colonel Cassad.
Yes. As Ben said, he's the action hero of the group.
Yeah. He's, his story is basically one of meeting this woman and having sex with her in various simulated battlefields.
It's pretty messed up. Because I guess they learn all their military training through, simulations. So yeah. It starts at,
some base on Mars. Or Agincourt. The battle, Agincourt, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I know this. Under Henry V, and he meets this, he chases a French soldier into the forest, kills him, and then runs into this woman who helps him kill this guy, and then they do it. And yeah. I was like, okay. And then apparently every single new battlefield he goes to, he runs into this woman and they have sex.
Yeah.
Apparently it really gets him going.
I guess so. And he's a pretty tough soldiery type.
Yeah.
He actually, I guess when we meet him, or in his post-military career, he's a little bit of a critic.
He starts speaking out against the military.
Yeah.
The hegemony military.
They're just a little too gung-ho. Plus, it seems like the battle, the big war where he got his reputation, might have been set up by the hegemony on purpose.
He did, well, the thing that he did was not very nice.
Well, no.
He, I guess you can locate people through this.
Oh, that wasn't even that bad.
Are you thinking of something else?
Yeah, the thing that got him promoted was there was the hostage situation by a bunch of religious fanatics on a planet, and he was able to home in on them.
That's what I was talking about.
Right, but that's not the thing that got him nicknamed the Butcher.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Even though he killed what?
Exploded, like...
Like, exploded the heads of several thousand.
Instantaneously.
Yeah. Which is a pretty good trick, if you can pull it off.
I mean, it would do the job, but when I read that, I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, it's an intense solution.
Yeah.
And then he got the nickname the Butcher of Brescia for basically engaging in a war of attrition, but that was the only way to fight that war, it sounded like to me.
Yeah. And when he's recuperating from an injury, the hospital ship he's on
gets
blown up, and there's this huge sequence where he, like...
This was the action hero sequence.
Yeah, he avoids being, like, sucked out into space or, like, impaled on anything, throws a dead marine out of a spacesuit, crawls into that, then when the ousters come to the ship, he murders the first two ousters on the ship, gets into one of their things, manages to murder all the other ousters, go and take over their pod, and entered Hyperion and landed without dying somehow.
Right. Where the Shrike gave him, where he meets up with his woman again, who gives him this freaky armor that can shift time or something, and helps her and the Shrike murder a bunch of ousters on the planet. And then he has sex with her again, but this time she starts transforming into this Shrike thing and tries to bite his dick off with a steel trap vagina.
Yeah, it's really weird. I was like, oh my god. And then right, like, he barely manages to escape getting his penis chopped off, and then he comes all over himself, and I was like, that's impressive.
That is impressive.
I cannot believe your dick did just not immediately shrivel when this woman turned into knives.
He must have been so close.
Well, they were talking, like, as she was turning into knives, he just kept going. And I was like, how have you not pulled out yet? What is wrong with you?
Come on, buddy.
If I was having sex with anybody, and all of a sudden, like, knives were sticking out of their chest, I think I would immediately leap back and be like, oh my god, are you okay?
That Cassad is a horn dog.
Murdering people really gets him off.
I guess. And he's on the pilgrimage to kill the Shrike.
He's pretty pissed.
Yeah. Like, you turned my excellent battlefield lover into a steel trap vagina.
Thanks a lot, asshole.
You're going down, thorn boy.
Yeah.
And so is Silenus.
Yeah, Silenus.
Story next. He's a poet. He's the character we know the most about as far as personality goes.
Yeah.
He is uncouth.
Yeah. He's definitely an alcoholic.
Yes.
He loves the word fuck.
Yes, he does.
Like, he says it borderline too much, even.
Even for us.
And he's been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah, he actually grew up on Earth.
Old Earth.
Right. Which is, was a long time ago, because Earth kind of doesn't exist in this universe.
I don't think that's too uncommon for science fiction stories.
Well, it's not terribly uncommon, I suppose, but it's usually more in the form of, like, if you get a few books deep into Foundation, they're looking for Earth. Because it's a myth instead of an actual place.
Well, I remember I liked that about Foundation.
Yeah. But, that, I think that's a little more common than, oh, it's just gone. Mars is still there.
Yeah.
They know where the system is. In fact, I think, somewhat, I think they visit Mars and maybe the next book even.
Yeah, Earth got blown up by a black hole.
Yeah.
My space didn't really blow up.
There were some researchers. I don't know if they're building black holes or doing what, but at any rate, they managed to make one, and it started eating the Earth from the inside. A historical event referred to as the Big Mistake.
The Big Mistake?
Capital B, capital A.
Of 38, or
which,
whatever.
Yeah, which amuses me greatly.
Oopsie.
Oopsie, our black hole accidentally ate the Earth wall.
Yeah, so Solanus is this rich kid on Earth, going around being awesome, and then when the Earth finally started imploding on itself, his mom sent him off into space in cryogenic sleep, and when he woke up after he got over his initial brain damage,
right,
he gets over his brain damage by writing poetry,
right,
because, like, that's always been his thing, is he's super interested in the classics and poetry, and he's writing this amazing poetry and becomes this crazy bestseller and makes tons of money, but only after the publisher gets rid of all the, like,
basically gets rid of all the literary brilliance in it. Yeah.
Just keeps in the stuff about old Earth because people just want to hear about old Earth,
right,
and then he becomes a hack writer, essentially.
Yep. And a very, very wealthy one, I guess. When you have an audience of several hundred planets to sell to, your bestsellers probably bring in the same scale more in royalties.
Yeah, a bit more than just here.
Especially if everyone's speaking the same language.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling would, like, own her own planet if
Harry
Potter happened.
The Harry Potter of the world web. she'd have a higher GDP than some governments.
Yeah.
She probably does anyway. Anywho, that is neither here nor there. But yeah, he goes through this. He has a long and fairly eventful life, because he goes from manual labor to, I mean, he eventually ends up on Hyperion with Sad King Billy, who's kind of a semi-mythological figure at this point himself,
mm-hmm.
who I think was, like, the exiled Prince of Monaco or something like that,
yeah.
I think it turned out. But he took all these artists off to Hyperion, and most of them were then eaten by the Shrike, it sounds like.
Yeah.
But that was Silenus's muse, which is why he's on the pilgrimage, to rediscover his muse and finish his cantos.
Yeah, Silenus wrote a ton of dreck, lost his muse, couldn't write good stuff anymore, and then on Hyperion discovered that his brilliant writing returned. But that meant the Shrike had to go kill everybody.
Yeah, when the Shrike wasn't killing people, his muse was not present.
Yeah.
And
then after everyone in the city died, then he couldn't write anymore.
It's not a good case of writer's block right there.
No. I also took issue with his, if you're a writer, you know you have to have a muse. And I was like, bullshit.
No, I'm pretty sure a lot of it is work.
Most writers would tell you that is, like, 100% false.
Yeah.
And that most of it, you're sitting down like, oh, it's a bad book.
Must type 1,000 words today.
And then 10% of it, you're like, yeah, this is great. But, like, 90% of it, you're just like, fuck.
Must put words on page.
Make story happen. Well, also, like, if you do too much of the inspired, like, I'm having a great time writing, when you go back and look at it, you're like, oh, I didn't make, like, plot or anything happen.
Oops.
I was just having a good time. Whoopsies. So there's that.
Yeah. And if you need to know anything else about Silenus' personality, just know that in the interim between being a poet, he was a satyr.
Yeah. He did a lot glorious.
Got himself genetically engineered to be a satyr.
He literally became a satyr.
He was actually a satyr for like 2 decades.
That was just silly.
It's all you really need to know.
That guy's nuts.
And next story, I believe, was Saul Weintraub.
He's an academic.
Yes, he's a professor of ethics, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter got stuck in a weird fluctuation in the time tombs on Hyperion and is now aging backwards.
Yeah, that's the big thing about his story. And basically him, he's just an academic, a nice guy, loves his daughter and his family, and his main characterization struggle is about God and whether or not he buys into this whole concept because of the Abraham story.
He keeps having, he had a dream involving that scenario.
Yeah.
With him and his daughter, though, rather than Abraham and Isaac. And so there's a running dialogue through his story, mostly of him with himself, basically playing both sides of the argument over why that would be an acceptable request for God to make of his people.
Uh-huh.
In the meanwhile, kind of in the foreground, I guess, trying to get Rachel no longer aging in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time of the pilgrimage, she is a rather young infant.
Yeah, a couple weeks old.
Down to her last few days before, well, no one actually knows what will happen when she ticks down to zero.
She disappears or dies
or starts aging normally again.
Yeah.
But
it's not entirely clear.
Yeah, he's visiting the time tombs hoping they'll open. That something in there will change her back. And, well, if you have questions about that, I happen to know something about that, but I'm not going to bring it up today. And so, let's see, then Bron Lamia.
Our only lady.
Yes. P.I.
Yeah. Her story totally starts as, like, just a P.I.
It's kind of noirish for a few pages.
Yeah. This handsome dude walked in and asked for help.
A little bit of reversal role, too, because the PI is always a guy, and this handsome dame always walks through the door, right?
Yep.
but no, a very attractive man comes through the door who later turns out to be a simulated personality of John Keats.
John Keats. That was odd.
Interesting choice.
But all right.
And she's trying to figure out who murdered him, except as a biological extension of an AI. By murdered, he means lost a minute of time somewhere.
Yeah, because you can't really murder an AI since their consciousness exists in the AI consciousness.
Right, and they don't even know humans don't even know where the hardware for that is. And probably if they found it, probably anyone who found out wouldn't make it back alive to tell the rest of us.
Yeah.
Seems to be my impression. The AIs are actually kind of a character in and of themselves. Well, I guess they're not yet, but they are this big monolithic thing that gets mentioned. And we know that they're really smart, and that they're really strong, and that they might have more stuff than humans do. We just don't know where any of it is.
Yeah, which is why Bron's a badass, because she, you know, has to have enough weightlifting material in her home. But, she totally ends up sleeping with this Johnny figure.
Yeah.
Wakes up naked to, like, six dudes bursting into the house and then takes them all out.
It's her action hero set piece.
Yeah, she basically says something like, well, fighting naked is a disadvantage unless you manage to push away the feeling of vulnerability, and then you're fine.
Right. And proceeds to pwn their ass.
She kicks ass.
Even gets information out of one of them.
Yep. She's pretty no-nonsense throughout the narrative. She's constantly getting pissed at Solanus for not taking things seriously.
Yeah, has a bit of a temper on her.
Almost murders him once.
And she's on the pilgrimage because Johnny was interested in Hyperion, essentially. And she may or may not have his personality embedded in a little loop of nanofibers inside her skull or something.
She's also pregnant with his baby.
Oh, yeah, that too.
So she feels like going to Hyperion's pretty important.
Yep, she's going to hang out with the Shrike. She and the three people contained within herself.
Yeah, I guess. It's a prime number. Three works.
There you go. And we have the Consul, who never gets a name other than the Consul.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They never do. They name everyone else, even in his story.
And his backstory is the backstory of his grandfather, and technically grandmother, I guess, right? But through the eyes of his grandfather, a ship crewman named Marin, who is one of the folks helping to get the colony of Maui Covenant turned into a member of the web. And so they're making it like a, basically a 20-year round trip to get supplies and...
10 years,
excuse me.
11 years.
It's 11 year on a leg. 11 years on a leg, right?
Well, he's gone for 11 years each time.
Okay, there we go. 11-year round trip. My bad. And carrying out this love affair with this woman on the planet.
Yeah, so she starts out as 16, or almost 16, as he said like a million times.
Right.
And then he sees her 6 more times, I think.
Yeah.
And then she's 70 the last time he sees her, and then when he tries to... Or the last time he comes back, she's dead.
Yep. Visits the tomb, and then starts a revolution, apparently.
Yeah, so the whole thing like with Maui Covenant is... It's basically peaceful tropical islands, and, you know, these indigenous peoples just living their lives. But then when the web gets involved... Everything on the planet gets super fucked up. And so, in honor of this woman's memory, Marin tries to lead this revolution with some other people, but they do not succeed.
Nope, doesn't work. I think he knew it was doomed to failure anyway.
So the Consul inherits all of this sentiment from his family, and he becomes an anti-hegemony dude.
Yeah, and an anti-Aster dude. And an anti-AI dude, and an anti... The Consul is basically a, I'm going on this pilgrimage because fuck everyone.
Yeah. He becomes a high up part of the government, so he can bring it down, basically.
He's an agent for the hegemony, and the ousters thinks he's on their side, but he's backstabbing them. But he's also backstabbing... the hegemony. He's not a double agent working for one side while working for both sides. He's like a zero agent.
Yeah, he's just trying to screw everyone over.
He's trying to get into everyone's confidence so he can destroy everyone.
Yeah.
He seems to be angry at the universe.
He's a cheerful person.
He's a cheerful person.
Well, his entire family's dead.
Yeah.
Including his wife and kid. So...
That's true. He's just not a happy guy.
He's good at the piano.
Yeah, apparently he plays piano.
Like a boss.
Like a boss. Let's see. And then our last pilgrim is Het Mastin, who sounds cool. He's a Templar.
Yeah, the Templar sounds like a cool race of people. They, like, fly around in these giant spaceships with, like, freaking huge trees in them.
Yeah, he flies a giant space tree.
Yeah. And they're, like, super zen, peaceful, you know, in touch with the tree and all this.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, this guy's gonna be crazy hardcore. And then he gets exploded.
Yeah, and then his story is, oops, got pureed by the Shrike. Well, we actually don't know what he got pureed by. We assume it's the Shrike. We're pretty sure it wasn't one of the pilgrims, at least.
Yeah, before he got to tell his story, so we don't really even know anything about him.
Yeah. His story comes up again in the next book, but I can't remember exactly what happened. anywho. Is that... We don't have any more character stuff
yet. No, those characters.
I mean, it's almost not characters as much as just plot backstory with several of them.
Uh-huh.
So, some of our issues within those...
Yes, we'll start with political, because I think that's the biggest issue happening in this book.
Yeah. So the hegemony is kind of tries to sell itself as the center of civilization, I think.
I kind of viewed the hegemony as trying to be, like, the government in Left Hand of Darkness.
Uh-huh.
Saying, like, oh, yeah, we're bringing all these worlds together. Now you can all share ideas and go to each other's places, and we'll keep an eye out and everything. But they're actually not these wonderful, benevolent... This wonderful, benevolent force, which, you know, the anti-big, corrupt government thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, and for one thing, Farcasting makes it possible for them to have a solid, strong grip on society, as opposed to being separated by relativistic distance and the Left Hand of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think practically speaking, that makes it hard for them to be benevolent and relatively uninvolved. And they do seem to have quite a bit of military presence for a government that claims to be benevolent.
Yeah. And I don't know, it kind of sounded like they would just do the thing where, oh, your world is part of the web now, and we're just going to turn you completely urban or into a tourist trap or,
yeah,
like, screw you over. It's kind of, I don't know, a lot of people argue that the world today is kind of one big global culture and not necessarily, there aren't as many pockets of culture anymore.
Right.
Because pretty much no matter where you go, you're going to find, like, McDonald's and stuff.
Right.
Even in Africa and the Middle East, and if you go to a cool exotic place, you're still going to find Western elements there, just because, I guess that's what America does, so that's nice. But, so I kind of felt like the hegemony was America-ing other planets, like, oh, Maui Covenant says beautiful tropical islands. So now we're going to, like, send millions of tourists there every year and build a ton of stuff for the tourists. And all of the natives are going to die out until there's, like, a very few amount who are just selling tourists expensive jewelry.
Right.
I was like, oh, wow, that sounds like Hawaii on Earth.
Destroy the ecology. Well, that's it's called Maui Covenant.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard not to make that parallel. Yeah, there's definitely an imperialistic streak in the hegemony. They also might have been responsible for the horrible war of attrition on Brescia, where Kassad made his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like they kind of goaded the ousters into a fight.
Yep.
So they could find out how well their shiny new military actually worked against them.
And the looming fight with the ousters at the end,
yes,
is revealed to be another example of them purposefully setting up the fight with the ousters so they could take over Hyperion.
Right, yeah. Because it was, like, it's a planet that no one wants and everyone wants at the same time. Because the unique things on it, people are interested in it. Otherwise, I think it would be pretty unremarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought the political setup of them was a little interesting as well. Well, first of all, they call their leader the CEO, which
mm-hmm.
amuses me. So the supreme executive is a CEO, just like for a company.
Yeah.
Which I guess makes sense when you think about it. Like, chief executive officer is kind of a generic title.
Yeah.
Instead of being a president or a prime minister or something. And there are senators, and the AI have some kind of input. I guess it's advisory. And there's something called the All Thing.
Yeah, we don't really know what that is.
Which we don't really know what it is, but you kind of get the impression it's a whole bunch of people plugged into the net and voting on things and giving opinions in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's, I don't know how you sign up to be one of those folks, but like a citizen legislator that is almost full-time just browsing politics on the web.
Fighting about politics on the internet.
Which is, I thought, kind of an interesting aspect of that universe. His view of how plugged in people will be, I think, is a fairly, it feels more realistic than some other stories I've read. I did go back and check the copyright date on the book, and the original edition was 1989.
Yeah, which surprised me, because the internet felt like the internet. And when he was talking about people needing instant data and getting all this, you know, pictures and blah, 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 just downloading it all. I mean, that's shit people do today.
Right. And people had their devices and stuff, but it wasn't, it definitely wasn't as like a cyberpunk type of view of the future.
Uh-huh.
It was just, everybody will have net access and everybody will use it all the time.
Yeah.
We're kind of there.
We're getting there, that's for sure.
Yeah, we're getting close.
Yeah, if you go places now that don't have free Wi-Fi, you're like, this is bullshit.
That's true.
And, you know, even 5 years ago, you probably wouldn't expect that.
That's true, I agree.
I was thinking about that today, how they're talking about how Netflix is available on all gaming consoles now, and people watch TV and movies via video game consoles and not just for gaming anymore.
Yep.
And I was thinking, man, like 6-7 years ago when I was just starting college, like, most people didn't have Netflix. A lot of people hadn't heard of it. People were, I don't really know if I want to do that or not. And like 5 years later, all the video stores were dead and everyone's obsessed with Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
It's ridiculous to think how quickly that stuff takes over.
Yeah, once it kind of worms its way in there.
Yeah, and like how high school YouTube started getting big.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I was a kid, people weren't running around with smartphones. This is bizarre, like.
Well, and like how you could now watch anything on network television without even owning a TV.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Our kids are going to be like, what?
What are you talking
about?
You
had to record something on a VCR. That's not stupid.
You can record something on a DVR. That's going to sound primitive by then,
yeah.
Probably. Like, why didn't you just stream it live anytime you felt like it?
Well.
It took a few years before they had that.
Why don't I have a smartphone? You're not 10 yet. Call everyone else has one.
Shut up.
Shut up, 8-year-old. That's what I'm afraid of.
You're lucky I let you live.
Little bastard.
Preemptively, making sure he's a little bastard status.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about political issues?
No, not for now.
Okay. Yeah. So religious spiritual issues is another big element going on. I mean, for the fact, I guess, that all the pilgrims are kind of different types of religious affiliations.
Yeah, a couple of them aren't religious at all.
But then we also have some of the obsession with religion. So in the first story, Father Hoyt's story about Duray, and how he finds, in addition to this weird cruciform thing going on, how he finds this giant, beautifully crafted cathedral, and through the best methods he can figure out, it's thousands and thousands of years old and wasn't created by these people who live there.
Right.
Which, if he was correct, would mean that it was created before Christianity started on Earth, which would mean that...
It has theological implications, I would say.
Yeah, like, basically he was kind of doubting whether or not God was real, and then he found this one and said, okay, God's real.
Mm-hmm.
And his mission becomes to tell the world about it, and he's hoping that he can boost Catholicism back into the spotlight. Because it's dying.
Yes. And that idea definitely will come back.
Well, the other thing that I thought was interesting, because we were talking about the cruciform things that don't let you die and you get resurrected in 3 days.
Right.
But they also bring you this immortality, and at the beginning when all the people are saying, you know, he of the crucifix cannot die, well, in just pure Christian terms.
Right.
If you are of the cruciform, if you're a Christian, you technically are immortal, because when you die, your soul lives on forever.
Right.
But in this case, they literally continue to live on.
Right. Though there is the slight problem of the thing does not appear to perfectly transcribe you, so over time, you kind of get flattened out.
Yeah, it's a good guess that the people living in that village act the way they do because they've been resurrected enough times that they've kind of lost all of their individuality.
Right.
So, if, you know, Father Duray does end up popping out of Father Hoyt in the next book, he will probably be lessened somewhat.
Yes. The Church of the Shrike, the Cult of the Shrike, whatever you want to call it. I guess they call themselves the Church of the Final Atonement. That mm-hmm. is the PC way to refer to mm-hmm. them. And they have this whole ideology set up around the Shrike being the Lord of Pain and coming to harvest humanity, basically.
Yeah, so when Rachel gets this, when Sol's daughter Rachel gets that aging backwards sickness, the Benjamin Button sickness, the bishop or eminence, who was that guy at the Shrike Temple? Close. In a position of power?
He was a bishop, basically, yeah.
And he found out what was going on, he said, oh, I can't help you, the Shrike, you know, was putting this due punishment on her.
Right.
That's what he does, so get the fuck out of here.
And then Saul and his dialogues, again, questioning why God would feel the need to present Abraham with the choice he does to begin with.
Yeah, and I guess if someone doesn't know the story of Abraham, real quick.
Oh, sure, yeah.
He was father of Isaac, and God said to him, basically, that he had to sacrifice Isaac to God. And couldn't really ask why, he just had to do it, to prove his love for God, I think.
Yeah.
And Abraham ties him all down, and he's all ready to stab him. And then at the last minute, like, an angel comes down and says, oh, wait, no, that's good enough. You don't actually have to kill him, because you were prepared to.
You were actually going to do it, and that's what we were looking
for.
So,
you're fine. And so, you know, the argument the rabbi in the story makes to Saul is, well, see, God didn't actually make him kill his son. And Saul says, yeah,
but he was
going to.
He was fully prepared to do it.
And that just doesn't seem right.
One of those big keystone stories in the Bible, one of the ones that gets referenced more often, and one of the also favorites of the non-religious and anti-religious snark at, I think, whether fairly or not,
mm-hmm.
but it is a story that raises a lot of questions, and Saul is not exactly the first person to have them.
Yeah.
But it was interesting, the amount of attention that his thinking on the matter got, I thought. Let's see here.
You wanted to talk about the new
Bushido. The new Bushido code. I just wanted to touch on it briefly, but Kassad referred to it several times in his story, but the idea behind it is Bushido, by the way, if you don't know, is the Japanese, like, samurai warriors type of code. And so the new Bushido is kind of a similar idea. It's, there is a moral, ethical way to wage war. I guess the 20th century and 21st century, or at least the part we've lived so far, wasn't horrifying enough to convince people, but something happens in the future that is so horrifying that all the nations get together and say, you know what, we're going to go back to the old system of having war, where we have battles fought as set pieces between armies away from civilian population centers.
Yeah. Stop killing civilians.
Right. And then Kassad gets his reputation as the butcher of South Brescia.
Because he has to abandon the Bushido code.
Right, because he has to engage in urban warfare, essentially.
Yep.
And it's not good for anybody.
That causes much death.
Indeed.
It's no bueno. I also just wanted to briefly bring up the feminist thing, because, you know, I can't resist it. There are 7 pilgrims and only one is a girl, which I was not a huge fan of.
I could have had 2 women in there.
Yeah, I was like, surely one of these other people could have been a woman.
Maybe Hetmastine was a woman. Except they kept calling him he.
Yeah. I would say, like, maybe Silenus has to be a guy just because of the weird satyr shit.
Mm-hmm.
And Kassad, I could see maybe. But I feel like the other ones could have been women.
Right. The consul could have been woman. Saul could have been Sarah instead of Saul.
Yeah. I guess Father Hoyt had to be.
Well,
he's a Catholic priest.
Right.
Could have been none. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And I know that this isn't like, I know Dan Simmons isn't just like, women are only for getting pregnant. But the fact that at the end that Bronn reveals she is pregnant, I was kind of like, okay, so you're the only woman and you're pregnant. That's awesome.
I feel like he was making an effort by making her able to like take down a team of six dudes single-handedly and make
it hardcore badass.
And by making Mina Gladstone the CEO, a woman who is well renowned for her toughness and no shit policy, basically.
Those two things are nice, and Siri, the consul's grandmother, was like a significant political figure on Maui Covenant.
That's true.
But there was a lack of women in some of the other stories, aside from like, oh yeah, I got married and then divorced a couple times.
Right.
Like, okay, that's nice.
I think that's a fair criticism to make.
So, one of the things I didn't like about Bronn that much, is that I feel like sometimes when people are like, oh, I have this female character and I have to make her, like, cool. Because if I make her too girly, people are going to get pissed off.
Right.
And then the tendency is to make her, like, a hard ass with, like, no sense of humor.
True, yeah.
And Bronn was kind of a hard ass with no sense of humor.
Yeah, she's definitely that character.
And I was like, okay.
Again, I think that's a fair criticism. It's almost like, and science fiction just seems to struggle with it for whatever reason. And certainly there's been some debate in like the fan author type of community, like the folks who go to conventions, those kind of people, because there's just this really weird tendency in, and maybe it's not science fiction specifically, but certainly in nerddom in general, there's this weird tendency for guys to really challenge girls who are in it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're here at this convention and you like this thing. Well, I'm going to quiz you on it. You have to tell me every single thing about it to prove that you're actually a fan.
I've heard that too. Like, a guy shows up in a Ghostbusters costume and everyone's like, oh man, awesome, we love the Ghostbusters! And then a girl shows up in a Ghostbusters costume and they're like, who's your favorite Ghostbuster? How'd you get into it? Have you read the comics? Have you seen the show? Do you know all the blah 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 blah? It's like, can't I just be a cool Ghostbusters fan? Like him? I've heard that that is a problem across the across the board, and I think what I've heard is like, as a whole, they're struggling to get over it, but I guess a lot of guy nerds feel like they're outsiders who are connecting with other guy nerds, and like, one of the stereotypes, which I think they should actually not like and fight against, is that, oh, they all got rejected by girls because they're nerds,
right?
And now they're just like alone, and that's why they hate women. And I think that's actually true in some cases.
I think there's an element of truth in it. I'd put it that way.
Yeah, I definitely don't think it's true across the board. Now, I mean, all the guy nerds I know are not like that.
Right.
And also are not assholes about women being nerds.
Right.
So.
So most of the women I know and hang out with are nerds, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, message to any bitter nerds out there. Dude, like, girls like nerds. They don't like bitter people, though.
I think if you're mad because it's like the popular girl or some bitch or whatever,
right.
It's something rude. It's like, okay, if she shows up to a nerd convention, she likes what you like. So instead of being hostile, she'd be like, oh, hey, you like the same thing I like.
Right.
Look how much we have in common. We could be friends. And then all of a sudden you have a girlfriend, so like, calm down. That's just my advice. My advice to nerds everywhere. I'm not even saying this is like a snooty hot girl.
Right. But I think authors over time have been trying to fight against that a bit.
Yeah.
Because I definitely like the opinion I've read on those kinds of things happening have been science fiction authors who have blogs or, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely want to include everybody, like, there are a lot of reasons for that. One, being a decent human being, but two, even purely for selfish reasons. Like, if you welcome everybody in, you can sell to more people.
Yep.
And it's just, it's pretty silly. There was John Scalzi wrote a blog post not too long ago, because
he's pretty feminist.
He is, though he is hesitant to use that word because of all the things it implies and all the shouting that happens on the internet. He doesn't want to get into that fight. He just wants everybody to accept everybody. But Red Shirts, which we reviewed, actually got like a Reader's Choice Award at some like romance fiction convention, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he popped in with a blog post after that to basically say, so I usually go to science fiction conventions, which are like 80% men, and sometimes they have trouble dealing with women being there. And he's like, and I was just at a convention that was like 80% women, and not a single person tried to like quiz me on my romance knowledge or determine what my credentials are. Like, we just hung out and had a good time.
Yeah.
So, like, let's try to be like that.
that's a weird choice for romance.
I thought so too. Like, I mean, there was,
there's no romance. There were,
yeah, I mean, as far as like a direct romance goes, there were elements of it, and the codas, like the relationship stuff in the codas, yeah, was fairly powerful.
Maybe that's why. There's like, the codas are the shit.
Enough people read it who also read romance to give it a, put it on the list of Reader's Choice Awards at any rate. Or maybe there was a science fiction category.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well then.
Well then, we do tend to get, we do tend to have fun with our feminism.
themes!
Okay, so because of the nature of the book, it's kind of hard to sit back and say there is definitely a theme, but if you look at some of the connecting elements between stories and such.
Yeah, that's what we tried to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's like this, so like it was kind of hard to come up with one for me just because I think there's all this mystery around what's happening. Because again, like this whole book is basically set up.
Mm-hmm.
For the second book, where stuff is happening pretty much the whole time.
Yeah.
And so I think there is kind of this element of mystery. I don't know if you really call it a theme or if it's just something that's in there a lot.
Mysterious.
Right.
The Shrek's mysterious, and then everyone's holding back some kind of secret or...
Yeah, kind of that... kind of that thing where every character has a secret and it's, we'll see what happens when everybody's secret is unveiled.
Yeah.
And in the open.
Yeah. One thing I picked out was issues of time across all the stories, whether, you know, someone's aging backward or having problems because of time debt or whatever, mm-hmm, or, I mean, even the fact that they're heading to the time tombs.
Right.
Which are the big thing on Hyperion. Time was always an issue. The Shrike himself or herself or itself can manipulate time, so that was my vote for a theme.
Yeah. And there's like this thread of suffering that happens through there too, and I don't know if that's just to fit in with the Shrike as the Lord of Pain, but
yeah,
like Father Hoyt is in physical pain, Kassad is like angry and almost got his dick bitten off.
PTSD. Probably.
Saul is very sad because his daughter has this weird disorder and may or may not disappear. Selenus can't find his muse and is
drunk all the time.
Can't deal with that. And the consul, and Bronn is lost her lover and is pregnant and confused and probably kind of pissed off too. And then the consul is angry at the entire universe because of the things that have happened to him. Like, no one's had a happy experience going into this.
One of the things I was going to bring up here, just because we said it was Canterbury Tales in Space, one of the big differences is that in the Canterbury Tales, each person's not only telling a story, but they're telling a story that has some kind of lesson to be learned.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the wife of Bath is telling a story about how y'all should stop treating ladies like dicks. And the partner tells a story about how greed is bad, which is funny because he's super greedy. But, like, you know, they're all trying to bring across points of things they believe in.
Mm.
And I didn't really think any of these stories had an overriding theme or moral in to them.
Yeah, so it wasn't quite that direct of a...
Yeah, but that was something I was kind of looking for.
Right, right.
Wondering if any of them were going to end up with some kind of theme or...
I do think what happens if you read the next book, and again, I'm not going to spoil anything in the next book because we're not talking about that one, but I do think that each of the Pilgrim's Tales does have a specific plot reveal, something that definitely drives what will happen after this book is over. And that's part of why I think The Fall of Hyperion is actually just the second half of Hyperion and not a true sequel. So, as far as symbols go,
pretty obviously,
the Shrike
is pain.
They call him the Pain Lord.
Yeah, and he's made of knives. He's made of... So, come on!
He's freaking made of freaking knives, man! And so just some interesting things. I mean, I think we've hit a lot of the specifics from some of these points, but, like, the setting and the universe is, I mean, to my mind, the main reason to read this book. Like, it's super interesting.
Ben harping on about his universe building.
Yep, as usual.
I guess one of the things we haven't really talked about yet is all the literary references.
Yeah.
We mentioned at the end of the last episode, Dan Simmons is a big nerd. So, I mean, obviously, the parallel to Canterbury Tales.
Yep.
He quotes Keats in it several times. He has several references to Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he had made up a couple authors, but you kind of run into that problem when you're writing science fiction.
Where right.
Well, I can quote authors everyone today actually knows, so I think I'm going to do that instead of making shit up. And I think it's kind of fun to see a literary quote and then have someone be like, what?
Right.
when Marin and Ciri sleep together the first time and she makes a Romeo and Juliet reference.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I have no clue what you're talking about. Although I don't know how many people would get that if you just quoted Romeo and Juliet at them.
Right. Or if you quoted Keats or Yeats at them.
Yeah, I don't know if I would recognize if someone quoted Keats at me.
I know I wouldn't.
I'd be like, oh, it's a poem, okay.
Right.
That's nice. It is really interesting to me, though, that Keats is a super huge figure in literature, like,
mm-hmm.
awesome, influential poet, whatever, and he did die at the age of 26.
Yeah, he was real young.
He was really young. That was nuts.
And then, do we need any of that?
No.
All right, strengths and weaknesses of the writing. So, again, I thought the universe building was really interesting. He just mentions so many things and kind of ties them together. Like, it's because you can build a universe. If you get too specific and get bogged down in the details, then there's no story.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't say enough, then it's just frustrating.
Or, it's too confusing.
Yeah, or you just aren't trying very hard.
Yeah.
It's possible too. And he just, I think he really hit the sweet spot for building just a really broad and deep universe at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, and we were talking about how this is focused around characters, but you don't necessarily get super deep into all of the characters. Or
right.
They all feel real enough, but none of them are, like, really super, super deep. And one of the things that makes all their stories so interesting is just the way they're being affected by this universe that he created.
Right, yeah. The universe was necessary for this story.
Yeah.
Because a lot of science fiction is a story that has a science fiction setting. This is a more pure science fiction story in that without the science fiction elements, the story doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Unless the Shrike is real and I just haven't known until now.
That'd be weird.
I kind of hope he's not.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
The book is long. Like Ben said, it's 480
yeah.
pages. It's pretty fast read, though, and it doesn't feel like it's unnecessarily long. Like, I wasn't really sitting there going, go, these stories last forever.
Well, that's kind of, I mean, I think it's kind of one of the strengths of it, too, because the characters are mostly, like, their story when we talked about them, we pretty much talked about their backstory, you know, and the characters themselves are not bad characters, but they're not, like, super interesting, memorable characters, except for maybe Selenis.
Yeah.
If one of the stories for one of the characters had been a lot weaker than the other stories, then that would have dragged a lot.
Uh-huh.
But I think they're all pretty decent stories. They're, like, decent to good stories that are told in a way that is very readable.
I thought most of the stories got more interesting as they went.
Yeah.
Like, some of them started out a little dull, but got interesting, so...
I agree.
That also helped. And the writing's good, but it's not, like, crazy amazing.
Right,
I don't think it was necessary. because the story is just such a, here's these neat adventures. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need amazing writing.
Right, I agree.
But it isn't like, it's not bad though.
I'd put it maybe a step higher up the writing snob scale from solid commercial writing, just for like the literary references,
yeah,
and such. And other than that, it's mostly just like a solidly well-written, does what it's supposed to do type of story.
Yeah.
With extra credit for quality of universe building.
Yeah.
Though he didn't invent a whole language, so.
So he's no Tolkien.
But he also didn't invent Tom Bombadil, so.
So
we'll call that a wash.
Even.
Yeah. So, questions.
What happens when they meet the Shrike, if they meet the Shrike?
Yeah.
The story ends right before they meet the fucking Shrike.
I know. What's up with the ousters? Is there going to be like a crazy space battle? That is an angry cat.
Oh my god in heaven. We learned in Bron Lamia's story that the AI are all up to some kind of secret business, but we don't really know exactly what it is.
Yeah, there's a faction that thinks humans are useful, a faction that wants to wipe us all out, and a faction that doesn't care which of those two factions wins,
yeah,
as long as their own mysterious objectives get achieved.
So mostly 2/3 of AI don't care if we all Hooray!
So you kind of wonder what's going to happen with that.
So what's your verdict?
I really like it. It's one of my favorite books to read. I don't know that I would say it's one of my favorites on an emotional level, but I find the universe really fascinating. It pretty much nails the sweet spot to satisfy my boner for universe building.
I was interested by it. I thought it was intriguing. I enjoyed reading it. Like Ben, it didn't really necessarily emotionally resonate with me. Like, I don't know if it's gonna, I think some of the stuff will really stick with me, like the really interesting new things, but not necessarily the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I would definitely say, if you're not way big into science fiction, then you might not want to read this book.
That is very possible, because it is, it's not hard science fiction, where it's lots of science, but it's pure science fiction, where it is very science fiction-y, exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe more so than anything we've read,
yeah,
so far, even. So, do be forewarned on that.
Yeah.
I am reading The Human Division by John Scalzi, which I think I said I was planning on starting last time we recorded, and now I'm about 50 pages from finishing it.
Alright.
So, if you want to comment or have questions, or I don't know, you just want to, like, say hi, then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
Yeah, like the Night Owl did on our Watchmen post, so thanks, Night Owl.
Ooh, all right, thanks, Night Owl.
You can email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us on the tweeters at novelideaspod.
And you can also find us on iTunes.
Yeah, and if you do that, then rate, review, etc.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Helps us get found.
Yeah.
So, next week,
we're reading a play by an Irishman.
Ooh, good. We can break out our terrible Irish accents.
Yeah! The Beauty Queen of Lenin by Martin McDonagh.
Indeed. With special guest.
Special guest. To be announced.
Yes, to be announced. We'll let her introduce herself. Or maybe we'll introduce her and not let her talk for a while.
So be the guest.
That's right. So anyway, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.